This episode of Shutters Inc. is brought to you by Hedge for Mac, your best resource for data backup on OS X. It's the fastest, safest backup routine for your video, photo, and audio assets with full bit-perfect copy and verification. Go to hedgeformac.com/shuttersinc for more info and to obtain a 20% discount exclusively for Shutters Inc. listeners.
This is Shutters Inc. with Bruce Williams.
Hi, and welcome to episode 346 of Shutters Inc. This is Bruce Williams from shuttersincpodcast.com, and joining me from Brisbane once again, Steve Peters. How are you?
Good, Bruce. It's great to be back.
Good to have you back.
Thank you.
So what have you been up to since we spoke last?
Done a wedding.
As in you photographed a wedding?
Yeah, photographed a wedding.
Nice.
Wasn't too bad. It's a favourite spot of mine.
Yeah.
There's a place here we called Old Petrie Town, and it's basically the council have moved a lot of the old buildings around the area, and the YMCA actually have the lease on the place. But there's a whole lot of older buildings there that they've moved, like the old Petrie Railway Station's there. So I find it a great place to go and photograph.
Right.
Because you've got a variety of things, and they then lease out the various buildings to different community groups and so on. There's a men's shed there. There's the old fire station. They've got a bit of a museum. So, yeah, you can have a bit of fun. But, of course, this wedding was on a Saturday afternoon, and they've got some great big old fig trees. But unbeknownst to the bride and groom, they had a medieval fair for 2 days.
Right. At the same time as their wedding?
Yes. Oh. And they put Hessian up to section off their little bit of the wedding.
Yeah.
But obviously there's two trees there, and the best tree really missed, you know, got the Hessian around it. And, yeah, it was all right, but it was just a shame that we couldn't wander the grounds quite the same.
Oh, right.
If there hadn't have been a wedding, you know, hadn't had the medieval fair. So, anyway, that's always, yeah.
Wow, testing. That seems like a bit of a case of somebody dropping the ball. You know, if you've got someone paying for a venue to, you know, for their wedding, you would think.
Well, I think the problem is that you're not paying for the exclusive use, and that's the problem.
Okay.
You understand what I'm saying? It's on a few acres, and I suppose you want this little bit here where the tree is to get married. They're having their reception in one of the buildings on the grounds. There's actually an old pub that they use, which I thought they were using, but actually they went to another place that I didn't even know existed. It just goes to show you. But I was pleased that on my way to photograph the bride getting ready, I decided to drop in and just check out, like, you know, how much of this medieval fair had the wedding taken over, rather than just turn up at the appointed time, sort of, you know, after. I was glad I did that little 15-minute recce.
Yeah, right.
So I didn't turn up unexpectedly and then go, oh, my God, what am I going to do?
Yeah.
And I was sort of able to say to the bride, well, you realise, he said, yeah, we only found out last week. And I said, well, I've had a look, you know, well, we'll just have to play it by ear. But so, yeah, it worked out.
Mate, how often have we said, you know, photography is 99% problem solving, you know?
It's also, I mean, when it comes to weddings, I know some people don't like doing them, but a lot of it is all about being prepared and preparation. And I like to scope out.
Yeah, I think you need to be as prepared as you possibly can, but always be open to the idea that life is going to throw you a curveball that you weren't expecting.
Correct. I've tied many a tie. And because I wear a tie to work, I find that easy. Although, interestingly, when you get to tie a tie on someone else, it's not quite as easy as tying it on yourself.
No.
And I carry safety pins and a few other bits and pieces that I've had to lend a hand with.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's sort of.
I remember back in the days when Shelton was the co-host of this podcast, him saying that you can earn untold brownie points just by keeping a emergency sewing kit in your camera bag.
Yes.
Because bridesmaids will always, you know, catch a dress on a fence post or something like that, and you'll just need to do a real quick stitch-up job.
Yeah, I must admit, I did do the course when Shelton and Glyn were running, you know.
CPW, shooting. Yep.
Yeah, when they were doing that, and I did that, and there was a lot of little things like that that were very
Cool. Now, a few minutes ago, you mentioned there being a men's shed.
Yes.
And that's jogged my memory. We've spoken in the past about Craig Wetchen and his Men and Their Sheds project.
Where was I? I saw a book.
That's right. He's released the book.
I think I might have been in Big W or somewhere like that.
Oh, right. You've seen the book in the flesh.
Yeah, I'm just trying to think where I've been.
Well, that must have been pretty recently because he only had the book launch in the last week.
Well, I was going to say, it's only in the last week, and I'm trying to retrace my steps now.
Yeah, so this started out as a personal project of his, of photographing a few blokes that he knew who had their own little man cave, shed setups.
Yep.
And it really grew in scope, and he's sort of tied it into the whole, men battling with depression theme. And although we've spoken about it on this podcast a couple of times, during the days when he was shooting all of this, we haven't spoken about it since he released the book. And so I reached out to him through the week and I said, hey, mate, you really should come on the podcast and have a chat. So I just wanted to mention that I will be having a chat with Craig Wetchen at some point in the next couple of weeks.
Oh, that'd be great.
Hopefully when Glenn's back, but I'm not sure. We'll work something out. Yeah, but I just wanted to say congratulations to him on getting the book out because it looks fantastic. I mean, I haven't seen it in the flesh. I've only seen what he's posted on Facebook.
I saw the front cover and I had a quick, flick.
Right.
And I thought, oh, what a great idea. And I think what caught my eye was the fact that recently, has there not been a men's shed down Victoria Way where they were going to close and then there was a public appeal and they've managed to raise money. So, and it's obviously this men's shed's been running for ages and, of course, as you mentioned, depression and so on helps that. I know my father's in a what you call a retirement-type village.
Yep.
And they have a men's shed there and, of course, I think it's more a get-together and have a bit of a bitch without the women. and they do little projects and, it's interesting sort of. But it does, it forms a great thing where they do stuff and some of them are more, I suppose, looking at doing things and that, occasionally they'll fix up something for someone and so on. So, it's great.
Yeah. So anyway, we will be discussing that with Craig in the coming weeks. I just wanted to give that a little bit of a plug to say keep an ear out for it.
Right.
So what did you come up with this week?
Well, not a lot.
Okay.
To be honest, there's not a lot. There's not a lot around that new lately. And one of the things I suppose I'll start off with is really, because I'm a Canon user.
Yeah.
And I noticed I'm not the only one that's put this something up because I think I saw – who did I see put something
Carl, up? Carl put up
Carl a – Schmitz, yeah. Yep. Also on the Canon 5D Mark IV.
Yep. So interesting looking specs.
Yes.
You're not sounding overly impressed there, Steve.
Well, I'm not It's funny, as you know, I've got this little love affair with this camera, the Olympus OMD, which I have bought out in front of my wife, and she didn't say anything.
Right. So I'm guessing you've now fallen in love with the smaller form factor, and the idea of a full size body doesn't appeal anymore.
I'll tell you one of the reasons that I'm looking at. I've got a couple of. Well, actually, I can sort of—I'll digress a little bit in the fact that I've managed to. I'm looking forward to a couple of trips coming up.
Oh, okay.
One in September is where I'm going with my sister and brother-in-law. We've managed to get the assistant lightkeeper's cottage at Byron Bay there at the
lighthouse. Oh, nice!
And they had a special where I've got 3 nights there where it sleeps 6 for half the price. It was 50% off.
Nice.
So I'm looking forward to being able to do some sunrise, sunset, star shots, whatever, with the lighthouse and different stuff.
Yep.
In October, November, I'm going to Vietnam and Cambodia for about 3 weeks.
Nice.
And then in December, wife and I are going off to the UK.
Tough life.
She's from the UK, so the funny thing is we vow and declare that we're never going back at winter again, but we've seen break here. We're actually going to go, so we're going flying to the UK. We're then going to Lapland.
Wow.
Now, when I went to book the trip and I told them I was a photographer, they said, oh, we've got this great Northern Lights tour. And I said, oh, thank you very much.
Mm-hmm.
I said, unfortunately, I said, my wife actually wants to go to Santa's village and meet Santa Claus.
Right.
Now, I may see the Northern Lights, and I get a feeling that February, March is actually a better time.
Yeah, they generally say around the equinoxes is the best time for...
So I'm not... What's the word? It'd be great if I was, when I'm there and we're going right up... I can't even pronounce some of the names of where we're going, but we're going right up almost on the border with, I think it was Sweden and...
Right.
So on it's quite a way up, but it should be an enjoyable trip. You know, you get sleigh rides, reindeer rides.
So you're taking the Olympus?
Well, this is where I'm coming to. The Olympus up in Lapland, one of the things is, of course, batteries.
Yep.
Keeping them warm
mm-hmm.
and on your body and then the camera. And I'm thinking, you know, you get the Canon, bigger battery, bigger, you know, how do you keep all this stuff warm? How do you carry all this stuff? And this is one of the things with traveling, as we all know. I mean, I've got friends that have got, you know, these great big wheelie bags that they expect to take.
Yep.
All their gear, and I very quickly learnt when I went to Nepal,
mm-hmm.
we went up in a little plane to Lukla, right?
Yep.
To the, what is it, the most dangerous airfield in the world.
Oh, okay.
Before you go to climb Everest.
Yep.
And I had one camera, two lenses, like I had a small amount of stuff, but I had to carry that on my lap. And in a small plane, when that's there and you're trying to look out the window and whatever, it is not very comfortable.
Right.
So I think you've got to realise that you actually need to trim down your gear a bit.
Yep.
That's where the mirrorless is, to my mind.
The better choice.
Better choice. Right. Having said that, getting back to the EOS 5D Mark IV, I've quickly had a look at the specs, certainly 30 megapixels, which still Nikon people will probably rubbish us and so on. The interesting thing is you can pay up $200, or I've seen, I think Digital Camera Warehouse sent me an email at work today to tell me I could put $500 down, you know, pre-purchase.
Right.
For delivery on the 9th of September or something like that. But the thing is, no one's actually saying what the price is. Although I do note in the US that it's $3,400, and I did a quick calculation.
Well, $3,499 actually.
Yeah, $3,499. Yeah. Sorry, just beg your pardon. Which I did a quick calculation, which came out to about $4,600 Australian. Add on GST, you're probably
about $5,000.
$5,000.
Yeah.
That's a lot of money.
So it's interesting. Carl posted the photo, the video from Frodo's photo. Hey?
I watched that.
Yeah, so did I. So Fro ran through all of the specs in the video. He seemed to think that the majority of the specs were pretty good. He wasn't particularly impressed with the choice of memory card slots that they've gone with.
Yeah, he felt that that was a bit retro, didn't he?
And that there were faster, newer technologies out there that they could have used but didn't, namely the CFast cards.
Well, the CFast cards, the other thing I suppose you've got to look at is have many people got the CFast cards? Are they out there?
I have no idea. It's not something I need to concern myself with.
It's the first time I'd actually heard about them, so I was wondering whether their thoughts were, well, yes, they could do that, but it might be another 4 years before they're into wider use. I mean, that's one of the things I would say here in Australia, I feel, is the memory card Yeah, I think overall what we pay for photography equipment in Australia on the whole is pretty good.
Right.
However, things like memory cards, we seem to overpay.
Oh, okay.
Is my opinion.
In comparison with other markets?
Correct.
Right.
Yeah, okay. By quite a bit. And it's almost like, well, we've got to sell you the camera at this because you'll go to Amazon or wherever.
Yep.
I always, when I look at stuff, go, okay, I know the price in America is this. And the thing you got to watch, of course, is if you were there in like California, say, buying it, there's a state tax you pay that's not advertised. So
no,
you,
that's right.
So you've got to be very careful. In New York, I think when I was in New York, I went to B&H. And the only thing I walked away from B&H when I was in New York was memory cards because they were like half the price.
Right.
And at that stage, there wasn't. I think since then, B&H have got some better shipping policies, but at that stage, it was very difficult to get the shipping at the right price.
Oh, okay.
For such small, because, you know, memory cards don't, you know, don't take up a lot, and especially if you take the wrapping away, which I had a friend from work go to New York, and they were going to B&H, and I said, can you get me some memory cards? Here's the money. I said, but you can remove all the cardboard around them.
Yep.
If you're stuck on, you know, space.
Yeah, yeah, it's crazy how much excess packaging there is.
Yeah, I suppose it comes down to, you know, I've got the 5D3.
Yep.
Would I like a 4? Probably. Could I justify it? Not at the moment.
Yeah.
I'd like a 1DX too, but yeah.
What was interesting, and this appeared on the rumor site that you linked to earlier in the week before the announcement was actually made, was the dual pixel RAW format.
Yeah.
Which I'm a little unsure as to how that actually works. I know that in the video that Carl linked to, Jared mentioned the fact that when you shoot in this dual pixel RAW, the RAW files double in size. So it's almost like it's taking two different images, but somehow they're interlinked.
Yeah, I almost got the feeling that one was almost, it's like a one was for shadow and one was for highlight, and then it merged them or something. I don't know. That's the feeling I got.
But that just sounds like an HDR where,
you know, it does, doesn't it?
They're talking about the ability to make micro adjustments to the focal point after the fact.
Yeah,
which is interesting. Yeah, because when I first saw that mentioned, the idea of, you know, post shoot, you know, focus adjustment, I was thinking, oh, Lytro, here we come. But the thing about the Lytro was it allowed you to move the point of focus all the way through the depth of field, where what Jared was explaining in this video sounds like the ability to shift focus will only be, you know, very minute. It won't be massive quantities like, you know, feet within the scene, you know.
Yeah.
So, but anyway.
Yeah. I suppose it's like anything, until we see one. I mean, I probably could be tempted to have a look and try and figure out, you know, just what it actually that does.
I'm sure over the coming days and weeks there'll be more and more video surfacing of the various features as, you know, certain high-profile photography bloggers get their hands on pre-release models, and, you know, we'll start to see images that have been shot with it and, you know, hands-on reviews and that sort of stuff. So I'm sure all this information will come to light in the coming days and weeks. But as you've suggested, it sounds like an early September shipping date seems likely. Would you say September 9th for Australia?
So it's 8th or 9th is what I saw.
Yeah, right.
With that, of course, the same announcement, there's been two new lenses also released, which are basically
to coincide with it.
Yes, which are basically, one's the 24 to 105 F4 Series 2, I think they're calling it.
Right.
And then I think they said 16 to 35 is another one that they've, two lenses they've released as well. The 24 to 105 is a pretty popular lens, although it's interesting, it's not one that I have. In fact, Glenn and Shelton got me onto Tamron, and in a lot of cases I found their lenses just as good. And as I say to people, there are a lot of gear snobs. I've got a few friends that will, in fact, I've got one person I know, I think, must have just about every lens that Canon make. And one of the things I learnt when I very early in my days when I went overseas, I took all my lenses and I probably only used two, and I had to cart around all this stuff. It was like, it's amazing what you can make do with. But the 24-105, one of the first series one that I'm aware of coming up in the second hand market, they do end up where the electronic ribbon basically breaks because, and so there's
sorry what's the electronic ribbon?
It's sort of like the, I call it the electronic ribbon, but there's a ribbon within it that carries the power for the, you know, when it, because it's a 24-105, that tends to break in the earlier models, and so you get an error message to say the lens doesn't work and won't focus and so on. And you have to get that replaced. So there was.
This is something to do with the AF part of the lens?
I think so, yeah. I can't quite remember. I also had a 15-85 was another lens that also suffered from the same sort of problem. And it cost me $300, nearly $400 to repair.
Right. Yeah, interesting.
But it is seen as, I suppose, the 24-105 is seen as probably the workhorse of the lens.
Yep.
For a lot of people.
Yeah, right. What else did you have on your list?
Actually, I will say I also watched the skin. Did you want to talk about the skin tones film stock?
Yeah, for sure. Who posted that? That was Adam. Adam posted this on the Facebook wall. This was a video from Vox.
Yes.
About the way film stock was developed originally to be, I guess, flattering to pale-skinned people, like to white people, and that it wasn't until probably the 70s or 80s that enough market feedback started to get back to the film stock manufacturers that, hey, you know, there are people with dark skin who want to be represented well in photos, that the industry started to change. This was quite news to me. I had no idea that this was even an issue.
No, and what I thought was interesting from watching the video was that it also came about from the likes of different wood grains and chocolate and so on.
Yes.
I was trying to say, hang on, we can't tell if it's light chocolate or dark chocolate or whatever, which I thought was interesting. So often, as you find on Facebook or anywhere, sometimes it's the comments that you can pick up some stuff that you say to yourself, okay. And some people were just saying, well, you know, if you think about, you know, the way it started, what happened, it all comes from the fact that that's the way people think. It wasn't done as a conscious thing. It's more just that's how it evolved.
Yeah. Yep.
And as the diversity of people and things like that happened and so on, it suddenly, you know, they realised there was a bit of a deficit there, I suppose.
Yeah. No, it was very interesting, Adam, and thank you for posting.
Yeah, I also thought it was quite interesting that it, I mean, you see there where someone built the, you know, the two different, to compensate for the colour in that, I didn't realise that it was sort of like, so, when I say so, what's the word? Recent, really, if you think of the history of photography.
Yeah.
Given what, was it last week we had 177 years of photography?
Yeah, I think it was, World Photography Day was this week past.
Yes.
Yeah.
The next one sort of comes that I put there was about, and I don't know how true this story is too, by the way.
Right.
The drone strikes a car on the Harbour Bridge.
Yeah. would be a hell of a fright to you, I would imagine. You're driving across the Sydney Harbour Bridge and then all of a sudden your car gets hit by a drone.
Yes.
So the story goes that this dentist was driving across the Sydney Harbour Bridge with his wife.
Yes, and his knife.
And all of a sudden this drone just hits his car out of nowhere. And he's had to stop his car in the middle of the freeway on the bridge and pick up this drone, and he's handed it into Castle Hill Police Station, which is obviously where he lives, because I'm thinking Castle Hill's nowhere near the Sydney Harbour Bridge.
Well, that's where he's working, isn't it? Castle Hill.
No, well, no, I th- no, he
well,
works
I think
in
that's
the
where
city.
He lives. Yeah, you're right. Yeah,
so,
okay.
But interestingly, a Civil Aviation Safety Authority spokesman said there was restricted airspace around the bridge affecting all aircraft, including drones. He said the fines for breaching safety regulations ranged from $900 to $9,000. So obviously whoever was flying the drone didn't come forth to claim it.
No. And I noticed there was some, I think in the comments, someone was saying that drone was worth like...
couple of grand?
Yeah, I think so. Someone was commenting on that, and it's an interesting thing because I've sort of been following the drone thing a little bit in the fact that I know what the CASA regulations are and what they're looking to, you know, some of the things they're looking to do. And interestingly, when I got this little drone, I thought, oh, I wonder what the drone regulations are in the UK. And I was a bit surprised that they're actually quite lax.
Oh, really?
Australia's looking at.
Right.
And of course, this is one of the things, as you know, I don't know if if you've seen it, but there was actually a drone hit an aircraft in the UK.
Yeah, we covered that story a while back.
Yes, well, yeah, and it made me look, and I was quite surprised that in comparison, their rules are quite lax to what Australia's are. In fact, Australia, I think, are looking at, they've talked about it, but it hasn't become regulation as to whether a drone under a certain size, you won't need a license.
Right.
But if you are doing commercial work, so that means that you're dealing real estate and different things like that, then you will have to be licensed.
Yep. That law has already been in place for a while.
Yeah, it might be actually that they're going to make it if it's under 2 kilos or something like that, you don't have to be licensed, which means you could do real estate providing the drone is in sight, which means you'd have to walk around the house as you did it or something.
Right.
I know there's some slight subtle changes, but interestingly, then I started looking, well, what's the drone laws in like Vietnam, for instance? And straight away it's like...
it's probably a free-for-all.
No, it's not.
Oh, really?
No. You pull one out there and it's instant jail because they've got like military type... Yeah.
Oh, seriously?
And then I thought, well, what's the laws in Lapland?
They have absolutely zero laws on the road. It's just a free-for-all
on the road. I was surprised, but apparently they are very, very, very conscious or I don't know what you want to call the word, but yes, if you pull a drone out, you might as well have pulled a gun out for all purposes. Yes, so, but which is interesting because, of course, there's reports that people are uploading to YouTube various videos and they're saying, well, okay, you're not supposed to be able to fly a drone there. And this is one of the things I think you may remember some time back that someone in Townsville got into a bit of strife because Townsville with the Air Force base there has some areas that are restricted.
Right.
The person was loading drone footage that showed that they'd actually strayed into restricted airspace.
Ooh. Yeah.
So it's like everything, okay? It's a bit like the Hoons that decide to upload a photo of someone doing a burnout and different things like that. It's great to brag about it, but you might just...
dob yourself in the process.
So I suppose drones are a thing that people, you know, certainly I know with privacy and different things, but you'd have to say when you see some of the work that they do use them for, there's, you know, it's an interesting thing, I suppose, interesting debate.
Yeah. Now, it's probably about time in the podcast where I mention that this episode of Shutters Inc. is brought to you by Hedge for Mac, which is the fastest app for importing and backing up your media on OS X. It will back up photos, videos, and audio files with the most simple to understand interface you will see, but really powerful nonetheless. One of the features that I love that I always talk about is the fact that Hedge for Mac will allow you to import from multiple media sources at one time and copy said media to multiple destinations all in one hit, which I think is fantastic. So, you know, if you've got a camera that uses two different card slots, one for shooting stills, one for shooting video, you can have both of those cards mounted to your Mac and be copying the data from both sources to multiple destinations all in one pass. And it does this with Hedge's Fast Lane, which is the fastest copy and verification engine you'll find, and it's even faster than Mac Finder. Hedge for Mac is optimized for files that are 100 megs or larger because of their background in video work, but they're now realizing that, you know, photographers need this kind of backup routine as well. Every file copied by Hedge is cross-verified with the original. There is full support for NAS, RAID, and for uploading to cloud providers. And you've also got the ability to use scripts to sort, transcode, rename, and tag your media after you've imported it. If you'd like a 20% discount, check out hedgeformac.com/shuttersinc. And we thank Hedge for Mac for their support of this episode of Shuttersinc. All right. What's next on the list, Steve?
Well, I hesitate to erase this matter because this is another one from Adam, and I noticed that even though Glenn in the States? Is he?
He's in the US at the moment.
He's in the US, isn't he? But I noticed he managed to comment on this one, but yeah. It's Adam's put here about this is something that Glenn is awesome at, which I thought, do we ever actually admit that? And I see you've commented, bloody hell, ads. Don't tell them that. We'll never hear the end of it. And then Glenn's come up off, you know.
Yep.
In some respects, you know, you look at this and say, but in reality, I think this probably shows at times what does happen as far as photography goes. But also I keep thinking, you know, when people say, I want to do a photo shoot, want to get, you know, and they sort of say, I want to be, you know, I want to have this great background and all this sort of stuff. And a lot of times you say, well, but hang on, who are we photographing? Yep. So, me. So why is the background important? You know, like, it's, we're not doing a selfie here. Do you know what I mean? Like, but it just shows you that how, you know, as Adam's rightly pointed out, I think a lot of, after you photograph a while, you do tend to do this. You do can make things look good, and people say, where was that? Where did you photograph that?
Yeah. So the headline is Ordinary People versus Photographers. Experiment shows how differently the same location looks. And it really is a great little expose of half a dozen images where one image has been taken with just, you know, what appears like a point-and-shoot camera in auto mode, and then, you know,
mind you, there's some I think there's some post-processing on the
definitely
shots as well.
Definitely. But also, I think, you know, they've chosen the time of day well to, you know, use the light. So you've got these contrasting images, one that's just taken by someone who's obviously not a photographer, and then you've got another image which has been posed with, you know, family members or whatever, but using the light and using compositional rules and just the amazing difference that it can make between, you know, those of us who, you know, have a bit of an eye for composition and light and whatnot versus people who just, you know, point and shoot.
Yeah. And I think it's probably a good little expose, for want of a better word, of how you can use your eye and how you can, you know. I hark back to Shelton. He says, walk the scene. And this is probably a good example of how, you know, you can make something.
Definitely. Definitely. And I think a lot of it also comes down to, and this is, again, something that both Shelton and Glenn have spoken about, you know, extensively during the life of this podcast, is pre-visualizing what it is you want from the shot.
Yeah.
Because if you've got an idea of what it is you want from the shot, then you can look at the scene in front of you, as bland as it may be, and you can see from these point-and-shoot shots that it is relatively bland environments. Yeah. But you can then approach that, you know, with an idea in mind of what it is you want to achieve and work out how to make the most of that scenery.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right.
So, yeah, I like that one. Thanks, Adam.
Yes. Now, the other thing I've got there, which cropped up, I saw, is a story about why I'm glad someone took photos at my father's funeral.
Yeah, this is an interesting one.
And it is interesting in the fact that I'm trying to think, it's a while now since I was at a funeral where someone did have a camera, and this is the interesting thing, was my wife said to me, why would you have a, you know, why would you take photos and all those sorts of things? And I have known where some funeral homes quite often will film the funeral because they're Skyping it to someone that can't attend but they're overseas or something like that, which is a different sort of thing.
Yep.
But I suppose, you know, you look at this and you go to yourself, you know, I thought to myself, here's possibly a market.
Well, here's the thing. A couple of years ago, my wife, Kath, her grandmother passed away. Her grandfather passed away. And her grandmother was still alive, and we all went up to near the Grafton area, up the north of New South Wales, for the funeral. And knowing that, you know, I was a photographer, her grandmother said, you know, would you mind taking some photos at the service for me? And I felt a little bit odd about, you know, moving around the church taking photos during a funeral service. But, you know, to her that was important, and she was most thankful that I took those photos. And, you know, and Kath then put together a small photo book, not only of the service, but with some of the photos that I had taken while Kath's grandfather had been alive. So, you know, her grandmother ended up with this little photo book that had some nice pics of, you know, Jeff when he was alive, and then some pics from the funeral. And that meant the world to Kath's grandmother. So it's, you know.
I mean, I can sort of, if you think of it, Bruce, and I've just, you know, quickly opened that article again, and I'm thinking, you know, when do people come together? And it's what?
Funerals weddings? And weddings.
Correct. And you sort of look at it and you say, well, if you think about it, it's a sad occasion, but at the same time, it may be for a lot of people the first time a lot of people, you know, family and friends, have actually got together. And it's, you know, I see some further on there where it serves a record providing healing for those left behind. But I suppose the thing is that there's a shot, obviously, of all the family members. And you think to yourself, you know, one of the things with a wedding that I suppose I've found enjoyable when I do them is where you take the shots of everyone arriving and also, you know, getting prepared. But it's the fact that the day goes for the bride so quick that they don't remember everything, and it's the photos that remind them.
That's right.
Of the certain things. And I suppose with a funeral, at times it could be you mightn't pull them out for a few months because, you know, you can't. But it's, I didn't know so-and-so was there or whatever. They didn't sign the book, or they didn't have a book to sign, or whatever the case may be. So I suppose, you know, when I look at it that way, I say, well, I mean, maybe people are doing it now with their iPhones, God forbid. So that was an Australian photographer too, by the way, so which I thought was an interesting.
Right.
So it wasn't something from America. It was actually an Australian article.
Yeah, right. Interesting. Even though it was on Huffington Post.
Yes.
Yeah, right.
Yes. Now, the last little thing I've got is just a
DIY project.
DIY string tripod. And this is old as old and whatever. But when I saw it, I thought it was quite neat in the fact that all you're doing is providing yourself, I suppose, with a bit of resistance to actually be able to have a steady shot. And in a lot of cases, you can, you know, fold the string up and a couple of bolts and have them in your pocket.
Yeah.
And you're not carrying a tripod per se. Now, it wouldn't be any good if you're going to do a long exposure or anything like that. But certainly, and then, you know, some people will say, well, you take a monopod and all that. But I just thought it was quite ingenious. And it could be a way to just train yourself to keep steady.
Now, I had a look at this article about 5 minutes before we started to record, and I looked through it, and I admittedly I skimmed through it rather quickly, but I did try to read all of the text because there wasn't a lot of text to read. And I'm looking at all the photos and I'm thinking, I got to the very end of it and it didn't describe how to use it. And then it was only when I went all the way back up to the top, there's one image right at the very top of the guy using the string tripod, which is the only indication in the whole story about how to use the string tripod.
And I'll have to say to you, look, I saw this and I thought of it, and I went looking for the actual story I wanted, but I couldn't for the life of me find it. But there are quite a few images. If you went to Google Image, you'll see there's different versions of what you could, you know, the one that they've got there is where he's using a, basically the string as a triangle. So you're securing the string under each foot.
Yep.
And then just bringing the camera up. So I suppose you're keeping the string taut.
Yeah. So I guess the idea would be to measure the string according to your own body height and size. And
But I've seen other versions where there's been, they've used it with other sort of landmarks and around your arms, done other, there are other ways of doing it, which I thought was quite interesting. So, yeah, look.
And I've, the first time I saw any variation on this concept, it was actually as a string monopod, where the idea was that you just simply tied a piece of string to the bottom of the, you know, assuming you've got your tripod mounting plate attached to your camera, because I don't know about you, but I leave mine attached to the camera all the time, even when I'm shooting without the tripod. So someone had the idea of tying the string to the little hook on the bottom of that mounting plate, and then simply standing on the other end of the string so that you're basically pulling the camera up and keeping the string tight and sort of having a string monopod rather than a string tripod. Now, I've never tried it. I have no idea whether it works, but it's just another variation on it, I guess.
Yes. Like I said, if you go into Google, you'll find some people have got very innovative and made it into Lifehacker has one where you got a piece of ply that you wrap the string around and put a bolt through and different things. And, of course, one of the things you've got to be careful is that you don't screw the bolt or the nut, all, you know, the screw all the way into the body and then crack the body and all that. Yeah. So you've got to be careful. And then I did read someone saying that if you've found a lamp or something, just trying to think where some of the bedside lamps or things like that, apparently you can take the lampshade off that and that's the same size that it would fit into.
Oh, okay.
So yeah, interesting, you know, when you start searching, but yeah, these hacks sometimes, if you're short on things, can work.
Yeah, right. All right, well, I've got a couple of more stories to cover, but before that, we'll throw to David Marland, who's got a very deceptive book review. Take it away, David.
Thanks, Bruce. This book has got a great title, one I really like, Masters of Deception. Now, contrary to what that sounds like, it's not 1001 sneaky things to do in Photoshop. That's not how to rip someone off. It's not even a book on photography. So what's the deception? Well, it's a book on art, but it's a really special form of art. It's all about optical illusions and playing with perspective. You might be familiar with M.C. Escher and Dali and people like that, but these are not the only people that have worked in this area. There are plenty of people who draw, sculpt, and paint optical illusions of all sorts. The book is really crammed with pictures, and some of the artists do some pretty amazing work. Now, Glyn would really like Shigeo Fukuda, a Japanese artist. He works in three dimensions because there's a welded pile of forks, knives, and spoons. Looks like an amorphous mass of nothing, but when the light is cast on it, it's a perfect motorbike. And then there's another shapeless mass he's made of bits of metal castings and things like that. Doesn't look like much, but when the light's cast on that, it's a perfect clipper ship. He's shaping with shadows. This guy has produced sculpture in wood, which clearly is a pianist playing at a grand piano. But when you turn it around, it's a violinist. And then to cap it all off, this guy has produced three-dimensional sculptures of two of Escher's most famous drawings, Belvedere and the Waterfalls. Belvedere, where the inside of the building becomes the outside, and Waterfalls, where the water's going uphill or downhill, but to do it in three dimensions. There's another guy that makes sculptures, three-dimensional ones, of shapes, like Escher's Impossible Cube or Roger Penrose's Impossible Triangle. But then there's a bit of a giveaway. If you photograph it from one angle only, it looks like that. If you photograph them from another one, you see something completely different. It's a bit like photography. It's all about the perspective. But another guy called John Pugh, you can view his work from any angle. What he does is he paints the sides of buildings that look like the revealed inside of those buildings. For example, the inside of a cafe looks like a revealed inside of an Egyptian tomb. A modern meeting hall looks like a Greek temple. And at an exhibition, he painted a bath on a shelf, and people actually spilled their wine, thinking they could put the wine glass on the shelf. Masters of Deception, Escher, Daly and the Artists of Optical Illusion is written by a guy called Al Seekel. It's published by Sterling Publishers, and it's available as a paperback from Amazon at about $11, $12 US plus postage, or the Book Depository for a bit over $21 Australian, which includes postage. The book provides lots of ideas for photographs and reminds us that perspective is really important. But if you want more inspiration of this type and you're a bit short on budget, I know a free way of doing it. GFGI. Just flame and Google it. Google optical illusions photography, select images, and then wow, there are heaps and heaps of photos where photographers have created optical illusions. It's really fun. A few have clearly photoshopped, but many of them are single shots. Some of them are a bit puerile, some of them are happenstance, but most of them are very clever. There's a guy with a moon in the wheelbarrow. And is that a long blonde beard that someone has, or is that his girlfriend's hair? And is that a profile, or is it a front-on face shot? There's a double-headed giraffe, a book cover that blends into someone's face, a kettle that's steaming clouds. This is really clever stuff. And this is about having fun with photography. I know to some people that mightn't be the greatest thing, but having fun, I think, is what it's really all about. So maybe next time you're on a shoot and it's all getting a bit too serious, or the kids are starting to get annoying, maybe you want to try something a bit different, and this might give you some ideas. Thanks, Bruce.
Excellent. All right. So the last couple of things that I've got, this was a story that I saw today on milliondollarphotographer.com. A guy who just simply refers to himself as Bradford had put up this, it was very much clickbait in the way the story was named. It was "Stop Selling Prints." And I thought, why would you be advocating to stop selling prints? And of course, the hook was that he was not saying that we shouldn't sell prints as photographers, but simply we should stop referring to them as prints and we should come up with more arty-farty names for them. And this guy's basically made a very successful business out, well, according to him, a very successful business out of simply managing expectations and creating more of a luxury feel for the product that he sells. And basically he doesn't sell any printed image for less than about $3,000, and many of his images sell for about $50,000. And according to him, he's made 24 mil in the last 8 years. So, you know, if that's the truth, he's doing very well and good on him. But it made for an interesting read. So
it's sort of, very quickly, I'm just reading through it myself. It sort of sounds a bit like there's a photographer here in Brisbane with one of the groups that I'm in, and he's very much into this type of...
That marketing approach?
Yes, yes. And, you know, he'd very easily sell 3,000. He wouldn't get out of bed unless it was a minimum of three, but he often sells up to $10,000 package of photos and so on. And
yeah, interesting.
At this stage, I've not got the desire. I don't have the killer instinct like that.
No, me either.
to do it. But I certainly do believe, and I could be proven to be wrong, but I do wonder whether in like 50 years, 100 years' time, whether actual prints or photos as we know them in books or you know, what we call hard copy, may survive a lot better than what's digitally online, because it's just going to get lost.
Hard to know. I think there will always be a certain type of art aficionado who will prefer a hard copy.
Yeah.
I mean, it's kind of like the difference between having a real oil painting hanging on your wall versus having a coffee table book that has reproductions of said oil painting.
Yeah.
It's just not the same.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, the same goes for quality photography. You know, a hard copy print is always, I don't know, on the odd occasion in the last few years when I've actually gone and printed something, I always have this aha moment of, why don't I do this more often? It's just so nice to hold a print in your hand.
It is. And I mean, I've got a few canvases and stuff like that of things, and I've got them hanging on the walls. And I mean, I took one of the Eiffel Tower, which apparently I found out since I shouldn't have done or something. I don't know. Or is it only at night you're not allowed to take a photo of it or something? I don't know. Anyway, you know, that I've printed out and hangs up in our house. And I think I've Cuba, I've got a couple of photos that I've printed. And it's just, you know, it does. It does give you great satisfaction to have them printed and see them there and so on, and not have to turn an electronic thing on and different things like that. So there is something there.
Yep. And the last story that I had, I mentioned last week the SonyAlphaRumors.com website. They had a rumor this week, which they gave a rating of 2, which, if you remember the discussion from last week, basically means doesn't hold a lot of credibility. They rate from 1 to 5, where 1 is, you know, totally unverified, 5 is highly credible and likely to occur. This was given a rating of 2, and it was that Sony is likely to adopt in the future a 16-bit uncompressed RAW format. The interesting thing in the article was that they speculated, will this only be limited to Sony's RAW software, you know, conversion engine, or will it be, you know, something that you can use in Lightroom or Photoshop or something like that?
Am I right in thinking Sony make the sensors for Nikon?
As far as I know, yes, they still do.
So does that flow through to that as well, I wonder?
Well, I guess that comes down to how Sony decide to market that, you know, that sensor technology, whether they want to keep it for themselves or whether they're happy to license it out to a third party like Nikon. I would imagine that the licensing fees would make it very tempting for them to cave in and say yes to Nikon. So, you know, I guess we just wait and see.
Is the bit rate, though, like 14-bit to 16-bit, I suppose? Yeah, you wouldn't think there'd be much difference, would there?
Oh, there'll be a heck of a lot of difference.
Yeah.
Every bit you add to the word to the word length doubles the number of potential values that can represent a shade of grey.
Yeah,
you know, so if you've got a 2-bit word, then you've got 4 potential values. You've got black, dark grey, light grey, and white, right? Yeah. And when you go to, you know, 2 to the power of 3, you've now got 8 values.
Yes.
So for every time you add 1 bit, you double the number of potential values that you can have to represent pure black to pure white and all the shades of grey in between. So going from 14-bit to 16-bit is a quadrupling of the potential shades of grey that you can represent in an image.
Which now sort of makes me then think, well, okay, what does that do for ISO and all those sorts of things? Like, does that make it possible that you could have a higher ISO without degrading? Yeah, like,
I don't think it de facto will affect what they can do with ISO, but I think it will create much better shadow gradations. You know, when you're trying to render those subtle...
So in other words, by default, it may actually improve ISO at lower... You know, like you might
possibly
say you had to push something to 3200 because that's what you could capture, yet you might find with the processing and the bit, you know, what they're capturing, you don't have to use as high ISO because of that.
Well, the
would that make sense? Would that seem logical?
Say that again.
Well, what I'm saying is, at the moment, because it's capturing in a lower bit rate, and they increase the bit rate, does that then automatically mean that what you might capture at, say, 3200, you can capture at, say, 1600, just because of the fact you've got that wider range of capturing the...
Well, it certainly means that if you're planning to export to an 8-bit format like JPEG, you've got far greater latitude to push or pull your exposure.
Yeah, yeah.
Simply because, you know, at the end of your production workflow, you're going to throw away 8 of the 16 bits yeah. that you've got in order yeah. to, you know, dither it down to an 8-bit image. So in theory, you could be, you know, a lot more underexposed or a lot more overexposed and still pull it back into a workable 8-bit format at the end of it. Yeah. You know, so, yeah, it'll be interesting to see whether or not this actually comes to fruition.
Yeah, be interesting to see if it gets some legs and whether it actually, as you say, comes off or whatever, doesn't it?
I firmly believe that it will. I mean, whether this particular rumour is accurate or not, I don't know. But I honestly think that given... another 5 years, I'm pretty sure we will have moved beyond 14-bit raw capture simply because, I look at the audio world. You know, when audio was first, you know, captured on computers, it was mostly 8-bit. And then, you know, 16-bit was the first time that we could produce something that actually sounded decent because 8-bit audio sounds like crap. And then we very quickly realized that 16-bit is fine as a delivery format, but it wasn't a high enough resolution for a production format. So we went to 24-bit and then we went to 32-bit. Yeah, and these days we produce all our audio at 32-bit and we dither it down to 16-bit before we release the final product. Okay. And I honestly believe that photography will follow in exactly the same footsteps, that we will get to a point where we'll be shooting 24-bit raw and then exporting to, you know, I think... The day will come where people will go, I don't want 8-bit JPEGs. I want 16-bit TIFF files to display on my website. and the thing is, we'll have the bandwidth, we'll have the storage, the networks will be fast enough, and we'll actually have the ability to do it.
Well, does that mean, and I say this, well, slightly with tongue in cheek, but do you think we might actually see where we have a SSD drive and a camera or something to that equivalent?
More than likely.
I mean, I'm thinking, am I right in thinking at one stage there was a video camera that burnt to a disc or to...
I think there was something like that quite a while back, probably 10 years ago now.
Yeah, which is sort of, I mean, discs have gone out the window, really, haven't they? Sort of. Yeah,
but beyond that, I can see a time where you won't even have storage in the camera.
Oh, it'll be to the...
The camera will simply connect to the cloud, and, you know, you'll link your camera to your, you know, Dropbox / Google Drive / OneDrive, whatever, and as you shoot, the images will just immediately go straight over the air to your cloud account, and that's where they will live, you know. I see that day coming probably within the next 10 years.
I'd even say could see it in the next 5.
It comes down to how much of the planet is covered with internet access.
Yeah, well, that's true. That's
you know,
true.
It's fine while you're in the big cities and the major towns, but the moment you go trekking up the Himalayas, you know, it's not a workable concept yet. No, but I don't think it's far off. I really don't.
That's quite possible. You're right. I mean, interestingly, just if we go back to the Canon... You know,
the 5D Mark IV,
yes. It's finally got Wi-Fi and near field, which some of the other cameras and certainly the mirrorless ones, this is where the mirrorless have sort of, to my mind, with the OMD, is you can use your phone as a shutter, as a recorder, as a, you know, like upways. I mean, there are some certain things that I think, and this is, you know, the criticism of probably the bigger makers is that they haven't necessarily looked at some of the trends that the consumer possibly are looking for.
I'm sure it's all on drawing boards somewhere.
Yeah.
And I guess as a manufacturer, and particularly in such a fickle market, I guess they have to weigh the R&D costs with the saleability of said product if they do bring it to market.
I mean, you look at, I suppose, I think, was it last week you were talking about with the Olympics, what they were doing as far as...
That was crazy. That was 2 weeks ago, yeah.
Yeah, Well, that's it. I had a week off because I had a sore back, and I didn't get to. I normally listen to the podcast on the way
on your
to work.
Commute.
Yes, yeah. And I didn't get, so I had to listen to two pretty well in a row because to catch up.
Jeez, mate, there should be danger money in that.
Oh, there should be. Well, wait till people see that I'm on this one.
Yeah. Well, mate, on that note, I think we'll wrap it up.
No problems.
Thanks for popping in.
No problems.
And, you got any shoots lined up?
No, I've got things happening here and there, and I've got stuff. I was supposed to do a shoot last Sunday, I was doing a shoot at an airfield, but the owners of the airfield, I think, suddenly realised that it clashed with a very big fly in nearby, so they've deferred it. But other than that, no, I haven't really got anything sort of lined up at the moment.
All right, well, enjoy your travels in the remainder of the year.
Yes.
And
after I've met Santa Claus, I can come back.
That's right. All right, mate, good to talk to you again.
No problems. Thanks,
and,
Bruce.
And until we speak with you again, take care.
Thank you.
ShutterZincPodcast.com.
AnotherAudioTo.com quality podcast.
For questions, comments, and feedback, email theboys@ShutterZincPodcast.com.